No one could claim a more distinguished intellectual lineage in the founder's generation than Timothy Dwight, the grandson of Jonathan Edwards. Unless it was Aaron Burr, Dwight's cousin and likewise a grandson of the redoubtable Edwards. But from that point, no two paths in the early Republic diverged further. Born on February 6, 1756, the boy Aaron arrived, as his mother, Esther Edwards Burr, put it, unexpectedly. And that continued to be something of a pattern for the rest of his life. His father, Aaron Burr Sr., was the devoted disciple of the great Edwards and became president of Princeton College in 1747. However, the senior Burr died when the boy was less than 2 years old, thus setting a melancholy trend, followed by young Burr's grandfather, Jonathan Edwards, who took the helm of Princeton from his dead son-in-law's hands in January 1758, only to die himself from a botched smallpox inoculation the following March. Esther Edwards Burr was also inoculated for the smallpox and likewise died 2 weeks later, followed by her own mother, Sarah Pierpont Edwards, in October. In the course of less than a year, young Aaron Burr had lost both parents and both grandparents, which, even in an age of high mortality, set something of a record. The boy ended up in 1760 in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, in the care of his aunt and uncle, Timothy and Rhoda Edwards, who had also taken in the orphaned underage siblings of Timothy Edwards. Burr's father had left a trust of over £3,000 to educate the boy for the ministry. And not surprisingly, it was to Princeton that he went in 1769 at the tender age of 13. But in spite of the cloud of clergymen that emerged from the Edwards nest, Aaron Burr was of a different plumage. Aaron Burr Sr. was a quieter, gentler version of his father-in-law, Edwards, even deplored boisterous methods in awakenings. John Witherspoon, imported from Scotland in 1768 as yet another president for the college, had been formed in the mold of the Scottish Enlightenment and its natural law, common sense, philosophy. But young Aaron Burr's 1772 class oration on honor had much more to do with philosophy, or perhaps more accurately, much more to do with personal fame and glory than religion. Man is formed for action, Burr declared, and seeks for honor and praise above all. He pursues lasting glory and true permanent honor to breathe peace and safety upon mankind, to rise above them all without any advantage taken by their fall. All of which might have been near to what we would expect to hear from a young George Washington at this age, but which clearly had little savor of evangelical religion. Burr was swept up easily into the enthusiasm, not of revival, but of revolution. He joined the Continental Army almost as soon as it was organized, and as son of the former president of the College of New Jersey, Burr was attached to the staff of General Richard Montgomery for Montgomery's ill-fated attempt to capture Quebec. When Montgomery was killed, Burr devotedly returned back alone and attempted, amidst a shower of musketry, to bring on his shoulder the body of Montgomery. But his heroics earned him little reward. Montgomery's death left him without a sponsor. And he wrote to Montgomery's widow that if Montgomery had lived, his friends would be in stations more equal to their merit. He found his footing again as an aide to the venerable old Connecticut general, Israel Putnam. He was promoted to lieutenant colonel, survived the winter at Valley Forge, and finally left the army in 1779. He turned to the study of law and married a wealthy widow, Theodosia Bartow Prevost, and moved into New York City as the British evacuated it in 1783. Burr clashed almost at once with another newly minted New York City lawyer, Alexander Hamilton. In these years before the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton devoted a good deal of his energy to defending one-time Tory loyalists in the New York courts. The New York legislature had passed in 1779 and 1782 draconian confiscation bills, bills that not only violated the terms of the Treaty of Paris, but which also drove out a useful segment of New York's merchant class. The war was over, Hamilton reasoned. These people were useful to the new republic. Why impoverish them by confiscating their property and impoverish the republic by punishing them further? Burr looked at the question from the other end of the telescope. Confiscated Tory properties could be sold and used to compensate impoverished patriots for their sacrifices, especially impoverished patriots like Aaron Burr, who had no objection to buying up confiscated Tory property at low state-set prices and then selling them dear on the open market. In 1784, Burr was elected to the New York State Assembly, where he allied himself with George Clinton and won appointment as state attorney general. Burr increasingly served as Clinton's foil to Alexander Hamilton in New York politics. And in 1791, Clinton muscled Burr's election to the U.S. Senate through the State Assembly, unseating Hamilton's father-in-law, Philip Schuyler. "I know not whether fame lies," John Adams gossiped to Abigail Adams from Philadelphia in 1794, "but she begins to whisper that Burr has been very fortunate and successful, as well as several others of Governor Clinton's friends, and lives here in style." By 1796, Jeffersonian Republicans were already talking of Aaron Burr as a possible candidate to run for president against John Adams. And yet Burr was already sending uneasy currents of anxiety through even Republican ranks. His political ideas, if he had any, were glib and mostly concentrated on his own self-advancement. "If you have the same opinion of Mr. Burr that many have," one New York Republican warned his brother-in-law, Robert Livingston, after Burr's election to the Senate, "you will not rely much on his friendship. 'Tis a pretty prevalent idea that he is a man who makes everything subservient to his private views." Hamilton was much more unsparing about Burr. "Burr is unprincipled both as a public and private man. When the Constitution was in deliberation, his conduct was equivocal. But its enemies, who I believe best understood him, considered him as with them. In fact, I take it, he is for or against nothing but as it suits his interest or ambition. He is determined, as I conceive, to make his way to be the head of the popular party and as much higher as his circumstances may permit. In a word, if we have an embryo Caesar in the United States, 'tis Burr." Burr cultivated the favor of James Madison, and, ever the gallant, introduced the 43-year-old bachelor to the widow who would become his wife, Dolly Payne Todd. Burr handed out copies of Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Confessions as a badge of his pro-French sympathies and denounced the Jay Treaty. And yet, he never quite shook off the suspicion of unscrupulous political climbing. Even Benjamin Franklin Bache's radical Aurora admired him only at very safe distances. Next in the train, the courtly Burr is seen, with winning aspect and with varying mien. Though small his stature, yet his well-known name shines with full splendor on the roll of fame. Go search the records of intrigue, and find to what debasement sinks the human mind, how far 'tis possible for man to go, where interest sways and passions urge the blow, while pride and pleasure, haughtiness and scorn, and mad ambition in his bosom burn. In the event, John Adams won the 1796 election, with Jefferson as his unenthusiastic vice president. But Burr still netted 30 electoral votes. And even though Washington personally struck off his name for a commission in the additional army, Burr is a brave and able officer, he remarked to Hamilton, but the question is whether he has not equal talents at intrigue. The Clintonites in New York were, notwithstanding, already filling his head with notions of the presidency. Burr sealed that expectation by swinging the 1799 New York City elections to the Republicans. And in 1800, he was picked to run as the Republicans' candidate for vice president with Jefferson. The problem was that the presidential itch was now about to drive him over the line. Jefferson easily outscored John Adams in the Electoral College, 73-65. But Burr, running on Jefferson's coattails, had also tallied 73 electoral votes. And this meant that, by the terms of Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, the House of Representatives would have to sort out, by ballot, one of them for president, based on a majority of states voting as entire delegations. Jefferson wrote uneasily to Burr on December 15, 1800, to suggest that this was simply an oversight. Decency required that I should be so entirely passive during the late contest that I never once asked whether arrangements had been made to prevent a tie vote by Republican electors. That turned out to be an oversight of near fatal proportions. Hamilton would have preferred the devil to Jefferson as president, and he did not hesitate to lay out suggestive snares in Burr's path that Federalists in the House might be willing to unload their votes on him. And for his part, Burr scooped up the snares with unbecoming greed. He did not openly campaign against Jefferson, but at the same time, he coyly declined to issue any statement promising support for Jefferson, and he allowed his allies to seduce Republican congressmen into voting for Aaron Burr. When the House of Representatives convened on February 11, 1801, 19 successive ballots were cast without a clear majority before an exhausted House finally recessed after midnight. Three more ballots followed over the next 2 days. After 7 days of haggling, with Burr's agents here at work with great activity, there at work, and with a total of 36 ballots being cast, finally, James Bayard, a Federalist and the lone representative of Delaware, withheld his vote from the tally. And the election was finally over. Jefferson was president. But Burr, said Bayard, had completely forfeited the confidence and friendship of his party. He enraged them still further by obstructing Jefferson's Replacement Judiciary Act in 1802. And in return, Burr's allies were coldly denied offices in the new administration. By the time Jefferson was ready for his second presidential campaign, he was anxious to be rid of Burr. And in January 1804, Jefferson called Burr to the executive mansion to tell him as much. There never had been any intimacy between us, and but little association, Jefferson wrote afterward. And the Congressional Republican Caucus, when it met on February 25th to renominate Jefferson, did not give a single vote in favor of Burr continuing as vice president. This ended Aaron Burr's career as a public man. but not his ambitions, or his thirst for revenge, which now came together to form the raciest chapter in his history. He struck first at his New York nemesis, Alexander Hamilton. Denied the vice presidency by Jefferson, Burr threw his hat into the ring for the governorship of New York in the spring of 1804. He lost, and he blamed Hamilton for it. Sending Hamilton a letter which claimed that Hamilton had defamed him during the campaign, Burr demanded a prompt and unqualified acknowledgement or denial of the use of any defamatory expressions. Hamilton refused to reply. And on the grounds that political opposition can never absolve gentlemen from the necessity of a rigid adherence to the laws of honor, Burr formally challenged him to a duel. Hamilton seems scarcely to have been able to credit Burr's insolence, especially since Hamilton's own son, Philip, had been killed in a duel only 3 years earlier. They met on July 11, 1804, on the bluffs overlooking the Hudson River at Weehawken. Hamilton, as he had announced in advance, fired his pistol into the air. Burr, however, took deliberate aim and hit Hamilton in the right hip, penetrating the liver and striking the spine. Alexander Hamilton died at 2 o'clock the next afternoon. If Burr expected this to restore his fortunes in the eyes of the Republicans, he could not have been more wrong. Burr was denounced as an assassin, and Burr complained that all our intemperate, unprincipled Jacobins who have been for years reviling Hamilton as a disgrace to the country and a pest to society are now the most vehement in his praise. Even John Adams, who had no reason to love Hamilton, grunted that no one wished to get rid of Hamilton in that way. Burr was indicted for murder in August, but prudently slipped out of New York before he could be arrested, heading for parts southward. The charges were eventually dropped on technicalities. The duel had taken place on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, but the New Jersey authorities were unwilling to press charges over what they considered a New York affair. And with astonishing brass, even for Aaron Burr, this lame duck vice president showed up for the lame duck session of the 8th Congress in Washington and presided over the impeachment trial of Samuel Chase as though nothing remarkable had happened. He had the impudence to give a farewell speech in the Senate on March 2, 1805. And then in April, Burr set off overland to Pittsburgh, down the Ohio and the Mississippi, to arrive 67 days later on the levee in New Orleans. For 20 years after the Treaty of Paris, the American Republic had squirmed in anxiety over what might happen along its distant western borders. Control of the Mississippi River Valley was vital to the prosperity of the trans-Appalachian West's economy. Yet the United States had next to nothing which guaranteed that its boundary on the Mississippi River could be protected from interference by foreign powers, the British, the Spanish, the French. The Louisiana Purchase gave title to the whole region, including New Orleans, but enforcing that title did not become any easier. Thomas Jefferson opened up every possible encouragement to Western settlement, but even at the best reckoning, there were only 50,000 American settlers in the Northwest Territory, and only 9,000 in the Southwest outside of New Orleans. Let any one of the European powers resolve on some scheme for recolonization in North America, there would be little the United States could do to stop it beyond the Appalachians. General James Wilkinson, the senior U.S. officer in the new Louisiana Purchase, admitted that our situation at New Orleans is a defenseless one. I most ardently implore that we may not be forced to war against European troops. Maybe it was a blessing that Napoleon had imbrued Europe in wars on the continent for so many years. But then there was Aaron Burr, who, if he could not reign in heaven, would rule in hell. which is more or less what he proposed to do in the new Louisiana Purchase. As early as the summer of 1804, while he was still the sitting vice president of the United States, Burr began dropping hints to the British minister in Washington, Anthony Merry, about his interest in helping the British stir up trouble for the French in the Caribbean by recruiting American mercenaries for clandestine operations. Filibusters is what they were called. The talks matured swiftly and quietly, and in short order, Burr revealed that he was prepared to lend his assistance to His Majesty's government in any manner in which they may think fit to employ him, including the astounding suggestion that he effect a separation of the western part of the United States from that which lies between the Atlantic and the mountains. Once he had an opportunity to inspect the Mississippi Valley himself, Burr was even more confident, predicting that not only the people of Louisiana, but even the United States forces stationed there would enlist with him. All that the British needed to do was back him with 110,000 pounds and a Royal Navy squadron to secure the mouth of the Mississippi River, and the deed would be done. Merry was not without a certain incredulity at this proposition, and rightly so, because Burr was also negotiating simultaneously with the Spanish to deliver exactly the same western lands to them. Still, Burr was doing more than just talk. He had assiduously courted, charmed, and dazzled everyone in the West, from a hatchet-faced lawyer named Andrew Jackson, one of those prompt, frank, ardent souls whom I love to meet, Burr wrote, to the voluble General Wilkinson. He recruited, according to his lists, between 4,000 and 5,000 volunteers and established a base on Blennerhassett Island in the middle of the Ohio River. To all of them, Burr confided that he had been specially commissioned by Thomas Jefferson to lead an expeditionary force to conquer Mexico. Burr had not counted on the double-crossing propensities of General James Wilkinson, whom Burr had promised to make his second-in-command, and who himself had been taking bribes on the sly from the Spanish for years. In October 1806, just before Burr was ready to spring his plan, Wilkinson recalculated the odds of Burr's success and then wrote to President Jefferson, betraying every detail of Burr's plan that he knew. Jefferson promptly issued a cease and desist proclamation on November 27th, and Ohio and Virginia militia staged a rowdy occupation of Blennerhassett Island. Burr, however, eluded them. He assembled his expedition at the confluence of the Cumberland and Ohio rivers at the end of December, and on New Year's Day, 1807, stopped at New Madrid in the Mississippi to do some desultory recruiting. For all his swollen promises and puffery, Burr had only 16 boats and 60 men at hand. He did not find out about Wilkinson's betrayal until January 10th, whereupon he scattered his pathetic little force and took to the hills. He didn't get far. Federal troops arrested him on February 19th as he tried to slip across the border into Spanish West Florida. It was at this moment that the Founders' Constitution revealed one of its most unsuspected strengths, and that was its willingness to throw the arms of protection around the liberties even of people who meant it harm. Article 3, Section 3, which was largely the work of James Wilson, defines treason as only levying war against the United States or in adhering to its enemies, giving them aid and comfort. That in itself pulled the punch of anyone eager to convict someone else of treason, since treason had to be an act rising to the very high level of war and its concomitants. In English common law, it was possible to accuse someone of constructive treason, which is to say that speech or acts which might lead to treasonous behavior. The Constitution not only excluded a doctrine of constructive treason, but also banned what in English common law had been a weapon to confiscate the property of convicted traitors, attainder of treason. Lastly, Article 3, Section 2 required that the trial of all crimes shall be held in the state where the said crimes shall have been committed, which in Burr's case would be in Virginia, since his base at Blennerhassett's Island was, technically, Virginia soil. And because this also fell within the boundaries of the U.S. Circuit Court for Virginia, the judges for any trial of Burr for treason would be Cyrus Griffin, the long-ago president of the Confederation Congress, and one of John Adams' midnight judges, John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Add to this mix Burr's retention of no one less than Edmund Randolph and Luther Martin as defense counsel, then it was clear that if the United States government wanted Burr's scalp, and there's no doubt that Thomas Jefferson wanted it very badly, since Burr had become an intolerable embarrassment to a Republican administration, they were going to have a long hill up which to roll their stone. It didn't lighten the prosecution's burdens to discover that the case against Burr was not nearly so transparent as it seemed. The constant crisscrossing of his intentions allowed Burr's defense to confuse and befog the issues. And though Jefferson provided his prosecuting attorney, George Hay, with blank pardons to induce Burr's co-conspirators to turn state's evidence, too many of them, like General Wilkinson, turned out to be suspicious and unreliable characters. And though a number of Burr's men had been clearly armed and assembled on Blennerhassett's Island, Burr had not actually been there himself, thus undercutting the actual association of Burr with an armed plot. George Hay tried to invoke the more expansive English common law definition of constructive treason. I mean, hadn't Burr planned some form of military operation down the Mississippi and recruited volunteers and armed and equipped them? But Burr's counsel insisted that the Constitution's narrower definition had superseded the definition of treason in English common law, which had no place in a Republican courtroom anyway. Vague and contradictory plans, on second and third-hand testimony, meant little. And armed men were no novelty on the American frontier. Burr himself insisted that his party of armed travelers were simply employees whom he was planning to use on new lands he had bought in Louisiana. Nor was George Hay, as prosecuting attorney, able to prevent Burr's team from turning much of the trial into a political referendum on the administration of Thomas Jefferson. On August 31st, after 2 weeks of trial, John Marshall instructed the grand jury that the treason indictment was groundless. Because first, the government had failed to demonstrate that Burr had commanded a warlike assemblage, carrying the appearance of force, and in a situation to practice hostility. And then, on the technical grounds, that Burr had not been present on Blennerhassett's Island, where the plotters had assembled. And Marshall did not mind taking a swipe at Jefferson in the process. The Constitution, said Marshall, had never intended that the hand of malignity may grasp any individual against whom its hate may be directed, or whom it may capriciously seize, charge him with some secret crime, and put him on the proof of its innocence. The grand jury deliberated for only a few minutes and announced that they had found Burr not guilty. Burr thus walked away a free man. And after several months of dodging his creditors, there were civil suits in process against him amounting to over $36,000, he boarded a packet ship under the name H.G. Edwards and sailed for England. He returned from Europe in 1812 and, boldly enough, opened up a law office in New York City at 9 Nassau Street. He made only a scanty living. And people pointed him out on the streets of New York City as the greatest villain on earth. Wicked he might indeed be. Perhaps the most wicked public member of the founder's generation. But even in the depths of his wickedness, and from nearly the pinnacle of constitutional power, nevertheless, Burr had not been able to jar the Constitution out of its accustomed course. To the contrary, the Constitution he came so close to destroying provided him shelter. If there is any testimony above all others to the wisdom and durability of the republic the founders built, it resides in the example of the dark recesses of the character and career of Aaron Burr.